Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 27, Humor in Harry Potter, Part 2, where Emily Strand and I will be talking with Louise Freeman and Caitlin Harper about what Harry's funniest, wittiest, most amusing moments bring to our understanding of these delightful books. Joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Today, my co-host is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of numerous Harry Potter essays. Thanks for being my co-host on today's episode, Emily.
Thanks, Katie. I don't know about you, but my gut still hurts from the last episode.
I know. I was laughing so hard. It was so much fun to remember those.
A total workout, just laughing.
Those are just, there's so many great moments. I don't even think we even touched the surface. There's so many good ones.
Right. Exactly. I keep thinking of the line ever since then, Fred Weasley, because I just read that recently. You had the whole world of ear-related humor. And you went with holy, you know, it's one of those, lines, you know,
yeah.
They just stick with you.
And it's about a joke. And it's also funny.
It's a meta joke.
It's meta.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. It's genius.
So we're ready to talk theory.
I think so too. We are picking up where we left off in our last episode on humor and Harry Potter. And we are turning once again to our guest, Louise Freeman, professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University, who studies the psychology of Harry Potter and other young adult literature, and also Caitlin Elizabeth Harper, an author, creative problem solver, community organizer, and wizard activist. I appreciate both of you staying for this second part of our humor episode, where we will delve into an analysis of how the humor works in the Harry Potter series and how it relates to the themes as well as the reader experience. Now, if you all remember, last time we focused on our favorite moments, and now we're going to pick up with our analysis of how the humor operates and why it matters to the books. Talk a little bit about some of the theories, and it sounds like some of us have been doing a little homework on this. And I read an excerpt from a book by Jimmy Carr and Lucy Greaves called Only Joking that does a really nice job summarizing the basic ideas, and they go into a lot more depth than I'm going to. But one of the things we've already talked about is the suggestion that humor is an aggressive call to revel in one's superiority. You know, that's the Death Eaters, you know, turning the Muggle upside down. You can see her underpants, right? That kind of thing. And that's funny. That is a kind of call to humor for the joke teller. It could be for the audience. It could be for both. A second theory is that it results from incongruity. You're putting two things together that don't seem to go together and having your expectations thwarted. So you think it's going to be one thing. One of the fan favorites that we didn't mention was when McGonagall is talking with Harry about Harry doing all these things to provoke Umbridge. And she's saying, did you do this? Did you do that? Did you do that? And Harry's like, yep. And then you think she's going to chew him out. But instead she says, have a biscuit, Potter.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really funny because you just had your expectations totally undermined by that moment. Another is that it comes out of discomfort, that's calling on two different emotions at the same time, and that your reaction is a laugh or humor. And then the fourth one is that humor is fundamentally subversive. It allows you to release thoughts and feelings that are verboten. You know, you're not allowed to really think those things, and yet this gives you a little bit of a safe outlet to do that. That's my little, my bare bones reading of it. But I know Louise, as our psychologist on the show today, tell us some more about the psychology of humor and where is that in the brain and what are some of the going psychological theories about it?
Well, you barely covered the basics.
Oh, excellent.
I mean, that's juxtapositions of emotions, this switching of expectations. This is all part of it. What is also, of course, interesting about humor is that it is a very social thing. We almost never laugh when we're alone. You're much more likely to laugh over a scene if you are sharing it with someone, which is why I think, you know, when you get into the fandom or when you get into discussions like this, when you're talking about your favorite moments with other people, it's just a lot more fun than if you're sitting at home.
I've had this experience where you read something super funny in the book and you immediately have to go tell somebody. And they're like, I don't even know what this book is. Exactly. What are you reading this to me for?
Exactly. And that's, I mean, you want to share it. I mean, this is why sitcoms put in laugh tracks.
Yeah.
It's for the people at home who are watching alone, so there's someone laughing with them. So they will enjoy it, and it will actually seem funnier to them when they are changing it. Again, you know, like I mentioned before, what is important about humor is that it does not go too far, that you don't violate anything in a way that causes serious harm or lasting damage or various things like that. And that, I think, again, is what having a magical world just creates more fodder for humor, because things that might be very serious in other circumstances, if you can heal any harm instantly by magic, it's suddenly funny. And that's a very important part. You know, another thing that I was thinking of is, again, with this perspective thing about looking at different scenes from different perspectives and how good Rowling is at changing our expectations, changing our point of view about something. The scene I was thinking of was in Deathly Hallows, when kids are out in their tent camping and they're overhearing Dean Thomas, and they're talking about what's going on at Hogwarts. They're talking about Jenny and Luna and Neville trying to steal the sword of Gryffindor and how they got caught and how Snape cruelly punished them by sending them into the forest with Hagrid. And of course, Ron is worried about his sister, and Harry is kind of rolling his eyes. Oh, you know, stupid Snape, you know, he thought it was punishing them, but they probably had a good time with Hagrid. And, you know, what's so bad about the Forbidden Forest, yada, blah, yada. And it said he inwardly, he felt this sense of release. He was expecting the Cruciatus curse at the very least. Well, get to the end of the book. Snape knew exactly what he was doing. Yes. He sent them into the forest with Hagrid because it was not a punishment, and because had he turned them over to the Karrows for punishment like he should have done, they would have gotten the Cruciatus curse, because that's what the Karrows did. So it's this, you know, it's not just an inversion, it's a double inversion. And again, requires knowing the full story, requires looking back on earlier scenes that may have registered with you as a completely mundane, okay, yes, here's Harry rolling his eyes at how stupid Snape is again. Well, guess what? Snape is going to turn out to be something very, very different. And that is both touching and humorous at the same time. Again, bringing those two emotions together and packing that real emotional wallop there.
Yeah, and I love that the humor, and especially when it's situationally derived, it can connect us with other powerful emotions. It may be, I don't know, does it soften you up a little bit? Makes you able to, like, open to some of the bigger emotions, kind of like what you were saying earlier, Caitlin, with the way that you have jokes really happening at the same time as really tragic moments, and that maybe you're able to feel those two things more deeply because they're put next to each other.
Yeah, another one of my favorites is when Molly Weasley says, "Promise me you'll look after yourself, stay out of trouble." And Harry says, "I always do, Mrs. Weasley. I like a quiet life. You know me." And that's like really funny, but then also terrible. Like, yeah. You know, it's like that to me. I was like, oh, just like it gets you like right in your gut or your heart when they make jokes like that.
You
right.
Know?
Right. Yeah.
Aww. Yeah. All right, now, a lot of what we have said has been really focused on the books, and a lot of it is the humor that you're reading. But let's talk about what the movies do and how the movies, which are such a different medium, try to replicate the humor of the books. They don't have the authorial voice. They don't have that third-person limited omniscient point of view that, as you all mentioned, is so important. I mean, how do the movies try to replicate what's in the books, and then how successful are they, do you think?
I actually had a couple other things, and I wrote this one down like an hour ago. I think Alan Rickman's performance in all of the movies added an element. It completely changed the character of Snape. Mm. His delivery of all the lines, like just the crazy way that he talked.
Obviously.
Think, right. Like,
obviously.
Like, you must be up to something. Like, my friends and I still quote some of these, like, written lines. And then you go back to the book, and all the book says is, "Children outside on such a wonderful day obviously must be up to something." That's what the book says. And then Alan Rickman's delivery has become a quotable / meme, and just his looks and everything. So, like, that's something that I did when I started watching the movies and just seeing his performance was going back and finding those lines when I was reading the books and thinking about his performance versus just the way the lines were written by Rowling. So he totally transformed that entire character, and Snape wouldn't have been the character that he was if it wasn't for Alan Rickman's performance.
I became convinced toward the end of the series that she was writing for Rickman, that there was an influence of Rickman on the dialogue that she was giving him. Because, well, and I don't know, maybe that's just me. I to this day, when I read it to my son, I just absolutely mimic Alan Rickman as best I can. I'm like, that's the best thing I could possibly do while reading to my kid. Him and McGonagall, like, I just
McGonagall's good. He totally like permeates. I think the opposite of that is Ralph Fiennes, where I think he's terrifying. Everything about him is terrifying. But as Voldemort, as the movies go on, I think and this is also like an internet meme thing, his Voldemort gets less and less scary.
Yeah.
And there are like jokes about his laugh in the seventh movie where he's like, "Harry Potter is dead." And like that laugh is like
when he hugs Draco Malfoy.
Yes, when he hugs
Draco. World's most awkward hug.
Awkward.
Like, he did not mean these to be, I don't know, like to be funny, but like just him in a different movie, he alone with no Voldemort makeup is terrifying. And as Voldemort, who's like the ultimate villain in the movie, I think just because a lot of it was so emotional, it became less about the battle against Voldemort and just like the battle against like humanity. And Voldemort, I played less of a part in that. And I feel like he tried to, you know, be a little too intense. So that was funny, which is like an accident. But Voldemort was scarier than Ralph. Straight up. And I don't think that they were banking on that.
I think what you said about Alan Rickman and also Maggie Smith is really important because they are both actors who are very good at both comedy and tragedy. And they're able to, they understand something about that that is absolutely transferred into the characters as they play them in the films in a way that maybe you don't necessarily get through the books. Obviously is the one that is the Snape line that I like the best. But the McGonagall line is the, "I've always wanted to use that spell. which I think is such a great, of course she would say that, but there's such glee and she does such a good job with it. I think those two, and Hagrid, he lends a lot of that same spirit to Hagrid as well. And I think it just, it brings a lot to what I think in the book is already a pretty humorous character, but Robbie Coltrane just did a fantastic job.
Jolly as Dan. Well, I often wondered, you know, and of course it's remarkable given how young he was when the series started, but Rupert Grint is so funny and was
very funny
as an actor too. I kind of wonder sometimes if Ron's character didn't get a little funnier because of the way Rupert played some of his characters. I was thinking about, you know, the scene where he's taken the love potion and you know is it's very funny as it's written, but it's even more funny when Rupert's playing him. The other one that if I remember correctly, there's nothing like this actually in the book. It's when McGonagall is trying to teach them to dance for the Yule Ball.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Calls him up and says, "Put your hand on my waist, Mr. Weasley." Where? My waist. And of course, the twins are laughing, and they're never going to let him forget this. And he's just completely mortified to be dancing with this teacher. And I think that's a scene that just really worked in the book that, you know, worked in the movie, was a bit different from the book, but was really just made for those two.
I find myself quoting McGonagall when she, I don't even remember what Ron says to her, but in one of the films, she says, "Thank you for that assessment, Mr. Weasley." You know?
Yeah.
I'll say that, you know, when somebody says something and it's just like, well, what do you say that? "Thank you for that assessment, Mr. Weasley."
Yeah. So incredibly Scottish sounding. Yeah. Daniel Radcliffe's performance during the Felix Felicis scene is a million billion times funnier than in the book. And the book is good mostly actually because of Slughorn. Because I went back and read it and I was like, yeah, Slughorn, his conniving and everything is kind of the humorous bit in that scene. But yeah, Daniel's like performance, just his like kind of drunk on luck thing. I think that's one of his greatest acting moments.
And I read somewhere that he said that he just played himself. He just decided in that scene, he was just going to be Daniel Radcliffe instead of Harry Potter. And that's the difference.
Because Harry's very broody and serious and everything. And the Felix Felicity scene is clearly like not that.
So I also love in book six, I just love all the Cormac McLaggen stuff and like all the little teen romancy stuff and all the stuff with him, like giving Hermione eyes across the table at the Slug Club. And then him vomiting on Snape's shoes. All that stuff. I just find awesome and hilarious. I don't know what that says about me, but I loved all of that. And I don't think any of that's in the book. Cormac McLaggen is just kind of a jerk in the books, I think. But in the movie, there was something funny about him.
He's definitely handsy with Hermione. When she asks him out to make Ron jealous, then she pays for that decision with...
He is like, following her around. It's mainly actually Hermione being funny during the Slughorn party, trying to lose him. Also when Cormac is lecturing everyone during the Quidditch game on the Quidditch pitch and they lose and Harry gets really exasperated. But just like this is going back to my favorite Quidditch, but picturing the chaos on the pitch when McLaggen's trying to like lecture everyone else who's playing in the middle of a game is just like insanity.
And wasn't Luna commentating at the same time?
Yeah. Oh my god!
I know. Yes. I was like, this match.
Mayhem.
If I go to any match, it would be that one. No, I want to go to Harry's first snitch catch, and I would want to go to that match with Luna commentating and Cormac McLaggen shouting from the goal and all this stuff, and Harry just like losing it.
You know, of course. What the movies also have is the music. They made particularly good use of that in Order of the Phoenix when they were doing the little montages with Umbridge, around and separating the kissing students with her wand and making them tuck in their shirts and all this type of stuff. There was that little bouncy little tune they were playing, and when she was hunting the DA and they were, you know, trying to get into the room and trying to find them, and, you know, Filch kept getting blown up and all this type of stuff.
I think Williams is like the second most important person to the entire franchise besides J.K. Rowling. Hedwig's theme and everything is just that totally made Harry Potter what it is.
I agree. In fairness, though, I don't think he wrote those themes. He did the first, what did he do? The first three? Yeah, I think he did the first three.
Yeah.
And then they played on those themes, but that theme came later. I don't think that was his theme. But I agree 100% about the themes that he did compose and how those carry the whole series.
Well,
for sure.
There's also that little, the music at Goblet of Fire, the little fight song when they're playing at the end of the tournament, which, of course, again, that upbeat, happy stuff, and then boom. Yeah, the tuba, the bass drum, and all that type of stuff. And then, of course, it all dissolves away when they realize Cedric is dead. But that was another lighthearted bit of music that enhanced the movie that way, which, of course, the books are not going to have.
All right, I am dying to talk about some of the things. You know, when Katie brought up doing this episode, I had just showed my now 8-year-old son the Potter Puppet Pals. And so, like, basically my life is not my own anymore because I have to recreate the Potter Puppet Pals pretty much all day. Summer vacation. So I am anxious to talk about, you know, the humor that Potter has inspired. So whether it be the Potter Puppet Pals, I just watched Puffs last night.
I did too, just a couple of nights ago.
Potted Potter, which I have not seen, but I know Louise has, so I'd love to hear. And all of the various things, the Dark Lord Funk. I mean, that song introduced me to the real song, and now it's one of my favorite songs. I mean, like, it's just, there's so many funny things that people have done Potter inspired. So what is this? Is this kind of like an extension of what Rowling is doing in the series as a whole? Or I mean, I know some of these creations have even expressed criticism of Harry Potter, and Puffs is full of poking jabs at Harry Potter itself. So what do we think? What do we think is some of the funniest fan creations, humorous fan creations? And what do you think that that's all about, that there are so many of them?
Well, you know, as you said before, humor is a way we express our intelligence. And so if you're going to go out and create something funny, you do it for something you really, really love. And this is, I think all of the humor related to Harry Potter is by fans who love the series and love it enough that they can joke with it. And that's, I think, the final point of that is that, you know, even as we are laughing at some of the in jokes, first of all, a lot of them are in jokes, which means you can only enjoy them with other fans, which again is that social aspect of humor. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's really a tribute in many ways to the series and how much it affects people that there are these creations out there.
Yeah, we see that in Wizard Rock a lot. I think one of my favorite fan creations of all time is the Harry and the Potter song about the price of Ollivander's wands. The economics of the wizarding world don't make sense.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
And I went to my first Harry and the Potter concert, and they played that song, and I was like, my wand only costs 7 galleons, 10 galleons for unicorn hair, -3 to Ollivander's. And I was like, this is the funniest commentary I've ever heard in my life. Like, and the song is like catchy. It's one of my favorite Harry and the Potter songs, but I was like crying at this concert. I was laughing so hard, like just doubled over. Like, it was amazing. And then it goes all the way, like another, like Wizard Rock artist Abby Ritter, she has a song called it's intersectional, and it's funny and serious, like critique on the lack of representation in the Harry Potter series. Mm-hmm. And it's super upbeat, and she, like, you know, curses in the song, and I know, like, everyone knows all the lyrics, and it's like, yeah, about how everyone in Harry Potter is straight, and, you know, there's no, like, Hogwarts is not, you know, wheelchair friendly and all that stuff. And it's funny, but it's like a serious commentary on the series and her and J.K. Rowling herself, as a creator of this thing that we love so much, and how, like, the fans kind of own it, and there's this battle over J.K. Rowling's ownership of the series and her, like, retconning stuff, and how the fans have created new things. And it's all, like, yeah, super interesting, always funny, but super amazing musical commentary on all of it.
There's a Daily Show episode, and this is a long time ago now, where, because I think it was Jon Stewart, back in Jon Stewart's days, where one of the African-American women, like, reporters is reporting, and she starts going off about how there aren't, you know, there aren't really a lot of black characters at Hogwarts. And she just starts going off about it. And it comes from a place of I do think it comes from a place of, like you said, Louise, loving the books. And then also like, but what about this? You know, so it's both loving and critical and funny at the same time, because we can kind of see where that's coming from. So if we've seen Puffs a little bit, let's talk a little bit about Puffs, because Puffs is really funny. And I think its whole premise is a funny one, which is sort of the point of view of Hufflepuffs who come into the school at the same time as Harry. And what is the Hufflepuff experience of the Harry Potter years at school? And the Puffs are, you know, they're joked about, and it's very funny the way they get around J.K. Rowling names that, you know, might be trademarked, right?
Oh, or copyrighted. That's hilarious.
Yeah, the snakes.
The snakes. The puffs, the smarts, the braves.
Yeah,
the
smart, brave, yeah. Puffs, and snakes. I just think that's hilarious. And they call Quidditch sports, which I just think is awesome. As a not athletic person, I love just calling it sports. And so much of it is so funny.
As an athletic person, it's amazing. Like, it's so true. That's the way we are,
right? I know.
And how they're not, none of them are any good at it, and the only Hufflepuff who they all have everything invested in is Cedric Diggory. Oh. And they're like, nothing bad will ever happen to Cedric. And it's that, like, you as the audience, you know, they're totally setting themselves up for something horrible.
Yeah, the dramatic irony is, like, I think when we were talking about Shakespeare earlier, I think Puffs is incredibly Shakespearean in its use of dramatic irony. Yeah. And all of these in jokes, and the audience knows exactly what's going on. And again, like we said, it's this shared community of humor. Like, it's all in jokes, and you need to know. And the Puffs have no idea. And, like, spoiler alert, but one of the best jokes in Puffs is when he asks Cedric if he can help him, like, learn magic. And Cedric says, yes, right after the Triwizard Tournament. And the whole audience groaned. And it's like, I was like, I was simultaneously tearing up and laughing because I knew what was going to happen. And it was like the greatest in-joke of all time. And then the actors are just looking off longingly into the distance, smiling at each other, and the delivery is incredible.
I thought that moment was really powerful too, and especially in the aftermath of it. And if you haven't seen Puffs, go, you know, you don't have to go to New York to go see Puffs. It's actually on Amazon Prime Video. You can rent it for a few dollars. I think I was able to see it because I signed up for a free trial of some.
Same here. We had the exact same thing.
Or so you could buy it. I bought it.
Exactly. You can buy it. You can rent it. You can do all these things.
Yeah.
So it's really great. It's what is about 2 hours, you know, a little less than 2 hours. And it's really a fantastic production. But I thought that moment was really interesting in the aftermath because what's his name? Dwayne. Dwayne is the main character. Dwayne, in his fifth year, you know, he kind of shows up drunk, you know, because he's been promised by this most famous Hufflepuff, this most prized, most talented Hufflepuff, that he would teach him, that Cedric would teach him everything he knew after the tournament, you know? And so he's dead now, and Dwayne is, like, depressed and sad. And of course, you know, Dwayne's experiences mirror Harry's in some way throughout the play, but you kind of get this, it's a critique too, because it's like, wow, this guy really had a lot more invested in Cedric Diggory than Harry Potter ever did. And Harry Potter yet is this, you know, angsty caps lock, you know, so mad, so angry about everything in life. And this other guy, you know, who's completely off stage in the main story, you know, has so much more, had so much more to lose in the person of Cedric Diggory. So it's really, I mean, it does what Harry Potter does in the fact that it puts dark and light things right next to each other and right. sort of makes us laugh while it makes us think.
And I think that the ultimate, you know, not to spoil anything, but, and so I won't spoil anything, but I think that when it comes down to it, Puffs is hitting all of those themes of the Harry Potter stories. I don't think it undermines them. It does, it shows you a different perspective, but then it hits some of the same big themes of, you know, friendship and loss and trying to grow up in this very dangerous situation in which they're having to go to school. And I did think it was, I think to me, it was what the cursed child wanted to be. In the sense of letting you revisit all of that. But of course, it's low budget, so you're not going to get all the cool special effects of like the cursed child. But in a way, it is bringing you back to all of that, but and giving you a different perspective. It's giving you a new source of humor. There's all kinds of stuff that's breaking the fourth wall, I think, right? And yet, it is just once again saying, yes, Harry Potter, and yes, all these themes that Rowling has emphasized for us.
Absolutely. It was really great. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I saw it twice. I saw it once, like, way back in the Black Box Theater, like, dingy theater. And I like, was laughing so hard that I cried the entire time. And then we saw it again when it moved to a different theater. And I would see it again.
Yeah,
it is one of the funniest plays I've ever seen.
Yeah,
in my life.
If you do get the video version of it, you have to watch through the credits because they do show you some extra things. And I just have to say, my all-time favorite moment was the sex ed class, because of course it's a school with teenagers in it. They're gonna have to teach sex ed, and I just thought that was hilarious. Maybe it's just you know, it's my it was just my kind of humor. I thought it was hilarious. That's all I'm gonna say. Maybe that will entice some people to watch it.
Well, I don't think any of you have ever seen Potted Potter.
Mm-mm. I have not, no.
Okay, it's playing in Vegas now. I don't know how long it'll be there, but okay. Apparently it's got a relatively long-term stay there. That was a really interesting. It's much more slapsticky, I guess, than you would say Puffs is. But, you know, it started as just a couple of guys who were putting on some skits to entertain people who were waiting in line for the Harry Potter movies. And, you know, they got more and more of these things, and people were loving their humor, their kind of SNL version, you know, parody of parts of Harry Potter and, you know, making fun of that. Of aspects of it, but at the same time, of course, really showing very good appreciation for it. And so they wound up, you know, getting their own show. It is believed, I don't know if they have verified this for sure, but at one point, apparently when this show was playing in London, it is said that J.K. Rowling showed up and wanted to attend, and they were sold out.
Oh no!
So they inadvertently like turned her away and said, "Sorry, we don't have a ticket." So, the one of the things they will tell you is that from here forward that they keep one ticket unsold in case she ever comes back, so they can to see the show but you know it's a two-person show, and you've got one guy playing Harry, and then you've got one guy playing all the rest of the characters. But one interesting thing I thought from it is that the kind of running gag, one of the many running gags to the show, is that one of the actors has actually signed on to the show without actually reading the books. So he's trying to like frantically read them between scenes so he can figure out what's going on. But he keeps mixing the storyline up with other stories. And the two ones that he keeps mixing it up with are Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings. So C.S. Lewis and Tolkien are the ones that Rowling is being compared to here. And I think that in itself is a pretty, you know, good tribute. That's showing that you think pretty highly of the series if that's what you're mixing it up with.
Yeah, these are all things that I think are worth taking a look at. So, yeah, really cool. And I think the fans, because Rowling's work is so humorous, fans want to respond to that humor, and they really, I think they do pick up on it. Now, let's talk about what Rowling is doing. And this is our last question. So when we look at other things that Rowling is writing, whether it's Cormoran Strike or Fantastic Beasts, do you think she is extending her humor to those, or is she doing something really different there that's not as humorous? Of course, one is gritty detective novels. The other, these are screenplays, so they're just movies that are being written. And so how does that affect the humor that's being relayed in those cases? What do you think, Caitlin?
So I have not read The Cormoran Strike. I am not a huge Cursed Child fan. I have seen it, and it's obviously much better to see than it is to read. But there is humor in that. I just don't know how much came from her. But did anyone else read A Casual Vacancy?
Yes. I did.
Yeah. So that I read that when it came out. And I was actually a fan of that book. I liked it a lot. And I feel like that had a little bit more of that snarky, sarcastic, you know, commentary, observational humor, kind of looking down on, you know, people that might not be as superior as the speaker or the author herself. And that book was obviously dark and depressing, especially toward the end. But yeah, I feel like that book kind of carried on because everyone was like, oh, you're going to read that Harry Potter book. And I was like, oh, it's not a Harry Potter book. It's not even
for
about
sure.
Magic. And everyone was like, yeah, that's by J.K. Rowling. And I was like, well, yeah, I'm going to read it. And when it comes to fiction, that was like adult fiction. That's very much my cup of tea. Like the rotating first person narrator and just things that were a bit darker. But I loved it because I did hear her voice the entire time through it. So I thought that book, I haven't read Cormoran Strike, but I feel like that book much more than the play kind of captured her voice and that humor that I missed from the series.
Well, personally, I thought the funniest part, again, won't do any spoilers because the theater experience, but the funniest part of Cursed Child to me was Moaning Myrtle. I think that was, Moaning Myrtle was just completely hysterical, at least in the production I saw.
We didn't mention her, but she's funny in the books, too. I mean, she's definitely a funny character.
And another one, of course, that is kind of misnamed, you know, like Fang and Fluffy. Moaning Myrtle is a very funny character, even though she's, you know, walking around weeping all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Or floating around or whatever. As for Cormoran Strike, there are flashes of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Again, given it's a real world piece of fiction and the stakes are a lot higher, you know, the humor certainly has to be scaled back. But some of the funniest parts are just sort of banter, I guess, back and forth between characters. There's some characters with good senses of humor, and there'll be you know, snappy comebacks and stuff. One of my favorites from the most recent one was Robin and Cormoran were talking, and there it comes again on the heels of a very emotional scene. I realize a lot of people out there have not read it, so I'm going to try to avoid spoiling it too much. But anyway, there's been a very emotional breakdown. Robin's collapsed and has been sobbing, and she's finally, you know, spilled her guts about her various problems or something like that. And Cormoran is talking about her and her marriage, and he says to her, you know, I'm no Sarah Shadlock, Sarah being the woman who has slept with Robin's husband. And Robin comes back with, well, I know that if you were that bloody annoying, I wouldn't be working for you. And he says, maybe you should put that in your employee satisfaction review. Not as bloody annoying as the man, as the woman who shagged my husband. I'll have it framed. And, you know, again, that's what he, it's a very nice use of humor to lighten the mood and to mm-hmm. kind of bring that, you know, their relationship has been on the odds for over a year because of Robin's marriage and a bunch of misunderstandings and not getting each other and this disconnect they've had. Well, that with that type of joking and that type of banter in the context of their professional relationship, which I think is very important, that kind of puts things back on track as far as those. The only other really laugh out loud moment I can think of from Cormoran Strike was from the third book when they're in the restaurant scene with the people from the body integrity identity disorder group. And when Cormoran realizes that the woman who's kind of being the obnoxious pseudo hostess there, even though she's not paying for the lunch, is not really paralyzed, that she's using a wheelchair because she considers herself transabled and is basically faking a paralysis. And Cormoran, of course, being a authentic amputee, is terribly offended by this and kind of explodes. And, you know, Robin is just, you know, scuttling, trying to get the check, is pleased and trying to hustle him out of there because she knew he was going to do this as soon as he figured out what these people were doing. And so she's like, check, please. Come on, out, Cormoran. We've gotten what we know. We need, let's, bye-bye. And of course, he gets out there and he's so furious. He doesn't even realize that she paid the check. These flashes of humor, but there aren't a lot of characters you would call funny. Oh, the Weasley twins funny, or.
Right.
I think Shanker is funny. Isn't Shanker kind of funny? He's also like, he's scary. He is, scary funny.
He's scary, and he's honestly, he's one who's much funnier in the TV show than he is in the book, too. The character as they play him in the TV show is, you know, he's not as scary looking, and he does a lot of humor well. But yeah, Shanker's probably the funniest character in the
series. I think that, and this just comes back to that social aspect of humor. I think the reason, like you were talking about, the funny moments are these interactions between Robin and Cormoran. You know, in Casual Vacancy, the humor amongst the young people, you know, the humor that they have with one another, those are where she really shines. And in Harry Potter, again, her successes at humor writing is a function of her success at building these character sets that work on their own, and then they work in their interaction with others. It's like a total, you can mix and match all the time. Like Caitlin, you said that you love professor on professor interactions. Well, you know, that's just one aspect. You know, that's just this little treat, because you mostly have professor on student interactions, which are funny in and of themselves. But then when you get the professors together, you see those personalities that you've got to know in this new light where they're peers. Fantastic Beasts is, on one hand, sort of a darker story than much of Harry Potter. If you can imagine a darker story in Essentials than Harry Potter, I think we had to have that with Fantastic Beasts. But one of the funniest aspects are, again, set into these relationships. So the relationship between Queenie and Jacob can be a very funny relationship. It's gone to a sort of dark place in the latest installment. But then also the relationship between Newt and his creatures. Mm-hmm. And so he has this strong relationship with his creatures where he ends up kind of Hagriding out a little bit, you know, with his care and concern and the things that he has to do. I'm thinking of the Irrumpet dance that he does in the first film. Mm-hmm. And how hilarious that is, but it's because he knows this creature backward and forward, and he knows exactly what to do to get the creature back under his control. And so he does it. He doesn't think twice about doing this ridiculous dance. And it's very, very funny for the audience to watch, because now we have a relationship with Newt as well. And we understand that his first priority is these animals. And so it's funny to watch, but because it's that incongruity, you know, you don't expect a self-respecting person to be acting like this. And yet, you know, there's this circumstance that allows him to. So I think that, again, her humor is just this function of her
writing these character relationships that are so absorbing. You know, we just get so absorbed in them, and then we're laughing right along with them because we're that shadow figure in the corner of the room of the story.
I think, too, the Fantastic Beasts, the romantic relationships, I think she does a lot of good romantic comedy. She's just got a good feel for that. And that maybe that's also one of the reasons why the Robin Cormoran scenes and the Cormoran Strike ones also often are able to convey a lot of humor. Again, it's very relationship oriented.
It's been a long time since I thought much about Casual Vacancy. But when you think about it, you know, a huge chunk of that book as well centers on a prank that goes wrong. I mean, this whole the kids getting online and with the ghost of Barry Fairbrothers. I mean, that was a joke. And yet, of course, had really, really very serious consequences for a lot of people.
Very Marauders-esque.
Yeah, how interesting. And that we've kind of circled back around. And I think one of the things that has come through our conversation is that the humor is not only something that J.K. Rowling is like putting onto situations, but the people that she's writing about, the characters she's writing about, they also are, they're trying to be funny and find the humor in their situations too. And some of what she's doing is commenting on, again, when that goes wrong, but also some of the ways that sometimes it goes right. And so that we can be let in on that. Maybe that's a part of that genius that she has for intermingling the comic and the tragic. This has brought us to a nice conclusion for our really stimulating conversation. This was really interesting. I had said at the beginning, when I contacted everybody about doing this show, I was like, this can't be like the Chris Farley show on Saturday Night Live, where we just say, you remember when this happened? That was the greatest. That was so awesome.
It was awesome.
It was hilarious. Yeah, I laughed. It didn't take us long to be able to find that there are really important uses that the humor is playing in these books for us, and that it is a part of J.K. Rowling's writerly genius that she's able to do that. That's part of what keeps us coming back for more as readers. Well, I want to give a big thank you to our guests today, Louise Freeman and Caitlin Harper. Thank you both for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. I don't know when I've laughed so hard on a, on a podcast before.
I know. Me too. And Emily Strand, thank you for being my co-host today. Always fun to talk to you.
Definitely. Thank you. You're very welcome.
I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Emma, you always make us sound great. Thanks for all that you do. Our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and our MuggleNet producer, Laurie Beckoff. Speaking of which, dear listeners, we are glad that you joined us today, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And I want to thank everybody who responded particularly to my Facebook post asking about what your favorite funny moments were. They were very stimulating as I was trying to think about those, and y'all came up with some that I had really totally forgotten about that were fun to remember. And now, listeners, I will leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "I would like to say a few words, and here they are. Nitwit, blubber, oddment, tweak. Thank you."
That was fun.
Such good stuff. Such good material.
Yeah, it was deep.
Oh my gosh. And I couldn't stop us from listing stuff at the beginning. I was like, oh, we'll just do another round.
Too many.
Oh,
I know.
Too fun.
There's so much I wanted to mention. I mean, I had the entire original insults from the Marauders map.
I had that on my list too.
They'll be announcing their engagement any day now.
Yeah.
Well, and I didn't mention the Brian part of Albus Dumbledore's name.
Oh, yes.
Brian itself is definitely a Monty Python reference. We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to have some fun and make some magic.